With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, the word is out. They're gonna talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 673, Nightmare Alleyways. Or if you're Kevin, Nightmare.
the Nightmare Alley.
Mm-hmm. Nightmare Alleys.
Me and seems like most of the population I hear say it. You guys are the only ones that apparently say it the other way.
You mean the proper way?
Yeah, the right way?
I guess.
If only it starred Josh Brolin.
Yeah, it'd be fine.
Brolin.
Yeah, makes everything better.
The wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yes. So I guess let's go around the, once again, virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
Jesus. This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. So Kevin and I are in real life, but Joe is joining us via the magic of Zoom, too, because the COVID has been sweeping through his workplace. He is fine,
correct,
but we're just
totally
erring on the side of caution. Because,
you know.
I wouldn't say he's fine.
Looking out
from a COVID standpoint.
Yeah, that's
from his baseline. Yes.
He's,
okay.
Yeah.
I don't want you guys to get COVID.
Yeah.
And, I appreciate it.
We've made it this far, knock wood.
Yeah, so far.
Same.
So
same.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing the.
So.
But we'll see. I don't know. It's you know, our vaccination rate is high, but this new variant.
In your department, not in our state.
Yes, the department. Yeah. Not anywhere else.
I went to Boston for Christmas or for Thanksgiving, and I had one of my friends at work was like, should you be traveling during all this? And I'm like, I'm leaving a state that's 50% vaccinated for a state that's 70% vaccinated. Like, I feel okay about this choice.
I'll be all right.
Like, I'm safer going to Boston than staying in Missouri. Are you kidding me?
That is an interesting concept.
Yeah.
I mean, the math checks out.
I'm like, just the other day, my kid got detention for covering his mouth when he sneezed. That's what it's like in Missouri right
now. Say what now?
I'm kidding.
Oh, I was like, God.
But the fact that you were like, that sounds true, though.
I got to tell you,
seriously,
that doesn't sound too far off.
I know, because you hear about those schools that, I mean, like, first of all, they've got the government here threatening to take away money or sue schools that make people wear masks. And then you've got other ones that are like, masks are banned places or something. So I was thinking, like, well, if it's one of those cases where you're like, I'm not going to take my mask off or something, and then.
Yeah,
see, that's you county folks. Us city folks don't have to deal with that.
Yeah, St. Louis City.
St. Louis City's like, nope, we're masking no matter
what.
Right,
yeah. Yeah.
And and then I work in St. Charles County, which is even more like,
they just shoot you on sight if you try to wear a mask there, right?
It's a different world, man. Like, so
it's the old no shoes, no shirt.
No problem.
Yeah.
Come on in. So before we get too far afield, too late. Shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. We should probably also point out that you can now leave ratings on Spotify. So if that is where you listen to the show, maybe scroll on up and click 5 stars.
That's probably super the most helpful rating right now. Cause I mean, obviously if you have iTunes, keep doing that. And we appreciate all those ratings, but Spotify, we need to build up the most. So if you're an Android listener and you use Spotify, that would be great to get those ratings up. So hopefully we can trend and be found on there like we did on Apple so many years ago.
Absolutely. So,
so many years ago.
So many years ago.
How many, you're totally right.
Years ago. It has been.
It's been like 6 or 7 years at this point. So
we did get a review.
Well, let's hear that. Unless they were so like, this is from... you woke bastards will be the first with your back against the wall when the revolution comes.
You know what? That one's coming.
Yeah.
We'll get another one of those soon. Don't worry. This is from I Hate Snakes Jock! Exclamation point.
Snakes. That's Why'd it have to be snakes?
5 stars. Very enjoyable and entertaining. I would like to hear your thoughts on the newly released Being the Ricardos movie on Amazon Prime. Maybe we'll get
it. I tell you what I thought of it real quick.
Yeah.
Do it.
I didn't like it at all. I thought it was a good script. I thought it was just woefully miscast. At no point could I believe any of those people.
Oh, any of them.
Any of them were the
J.K.
four people.
Simmons?
Yeah. Like he's the closest.
Who was J.K. Simmons?
Fred Mertz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and but I didn't buy any of them as the four principal characters, and it's a shame because I love the history of television. Yeah. Like, I mean, the whole time watching the movie, I'm telling my wife, I'm like, oh, this is where this happens, and like, like, so did you know that Desi Arnaz invented the three camera setup for sitcoms, and like, no, like, yeah. And so like, the script was great. I love the story, but the cat, I could not get past the cast.
That's...
None of them looked like or acted like they were supposed to.
That's tough when they try to cast things to get star power.
Sure.
And then performances and great actors, they hope equates to Oscars and award nominations and all that. So, you know, they're a little loose with the casting sometimes, but that's
tough
because...
Loosey.
Yeah, see? And it's tough because, like, Javier Bardem is a great actor.
Yeah.
Much larger than Desi Arnaz. Does not look. I mean, but
that, oh, you mean physically?
No, physically, a lot larger, more muscular than Desi Arnaz. He just doesn't look like him in the slightest.
Yeah.
So he also, I always feel like Javier Bardem kind of has like that menacing quality to him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like anytime he's on screen, you're just kind of like, well, all right, he might.
It's because of No Country.
It's
hard to shake that.
James Bond, like all that stuff.
But that's why, I mean, when you break out as in a role like that, it's really hard to not get typecast or to be thought of. You know what I mean? That when he was the bad hair guy in No Country, I always forget that guy's name.
I didn't care for that movie.
I know. It's
think that's a good movie.
I mean, people love it. It just did not work.
I think he is the draw for me. Like he's so good in that movie.
Oh yeah. He's perfect in that. Like he plays that so perfectly, but yeah, that's why you remember him.
That scene in the gas station might be one of my favorite scenes.
Right, that's the one. Right, that's the clip. Right, that's his clip.
Oh, the coin flip. Yeah,
you know that's
so good.
But yeah. So overall, like I said, it was a good script. I mean, it's Aaron Sorkin, so like that. But I just
did he direct it too?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just did not care for the actors.
I'm guessing that's, I mean, now that he's directed a couple, written and directed, like I think that's his thing now.
Totally,
he writes them and he's going to direct them, and if he can't do it, then he won't make that.
That being said, it's not awful. Like I don't want to make it sound like it's completely horrendous. And also, if you don't know the story or know a lot about TV history, it's fascinating. So like the story might overpower, especially if you didn't grow up watching I Love Lucy, so those characters aren't as ingrained in your memory.
Which
as,
you got to remember, it's like we're so far removed.
Totally.
Like, I mean, I grew up watching the reruns.
Yeah.
And loved them. But I mean, but we
so
were on reruns.
Just for the record.
Okay, yeah. True. But like, so they were already so far removed for us. It's like now you got to think kids growing up. And you know how we've talked about before that there's a generation where black and white is just
non-starter.
I mean,
No, thank you.
And also, like when I was a kid, I Love Lucy was like a staple of reruns where I think when you were a kid, like it would pop up on Nick at Night sometimes, but it wasn't like when I was a kid, it was always it was like whoever had the rights, they built their rerun programming around I Love Lucy.
Oh, sure.
Like, especially because there were so many episodes. I think it only ran for like 6 seasons, but like it produced like, I mean, at one point they were doing like 30 episodes, 35 episodes a season.
Yeah, there were a ton. But I mean, because it was like, I mean, it was like live theater, you know, they had live audiences. And so I think it was.
And it was a hit. So the network was like, give us more of these. Another one that's like that is Leave It to Beaver. It ran for 5 seasons, but they were doing like 39 episodes a season.
I remember I've never seen the same episode twice.
I was thinking about Leave. Oh, I've seen that show probably all the way through like 4 times. Because it was always on when I was a kid. And, sure. But I remember, like, not too long ago, I was like, wait, it only ran for 5 seasons. Why? How? Like, I feel like there are like a million episodes. And I'm like, oh, there are. I looked it up and it was like they were doing like 39 episodes a season, which.
What's the standard now?
Well, now it's like 13. But for network television, it's like 22 to 24.
There we go. Okay.
And so, I mean, so by modern day network equivalents, one of their seasons is equivalent to like 1.5 modern day seasons.
Sure.
You know, or even maybe 1.75.
So Beaver wasn't getting $1 million an episode either.
Well, they were probably also like, you got to crank them out while this kid's young.
Right.
You
That's
know?
Probably true.
Like,
yeah.
You can't do 12 of these and come back. It'd be Stranger Things. Yeah. Totally.
But they're also probably all salaried. So it's like, you know, they probably didn't
know how.
Pay
I mean, they didn't have syndication back then. So nobody got rerun deals or anything. So
I mean, if it was just their job, like show up. This is this week's episode. That sounds like they did one almost every week.
Wally and the Beaver still show up to like the Williamsburg autograph signing convention because they don't get money from the box sets and all that.
That's crazy. From the box sets, even if you buy a season, they don't get money for that?
I don't think they have
deals like that.
They didn't even think about that. They were just employees.
So
being the Ricardos doesn't touch on this, but part of the reason Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, what made them so visionary and eventually so rich, was they wanted them to shoot that show in New York. Because that's where radio and television was based out of at the time, right? And she had a hit radio show that they were turning into a TV show. And all the TV shows at that point were pretty much live, right? And so you did it where theater was done. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to be in California where movies were at. And so they were like, well, let's just film it. Like, why are we doing these live? Let's just film it. And the network was like, well, we already have a process in place for doing live television. If you want to film it, that costs extra money. And so they were like, well, that's what we want to do. And the network was, well, then you have to pay for it.
Okay, then we own it.
And then Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz turned around and said, you know what? We will pay for it, but then we get to own it, and it's ours now. And the network was like, okay,
whatever.
What are we going to do with this?
Thanks.
Like, what would we ever do with this? Yeah. Content.
Thanks for footing
and
the bill.
And IP.
Because that's like, I mean,
didn't think like
the
that
live stuff. I mean, they never record it. Like, so much stuff is lost. These amazing live performances. Because,
yeah, when you see those old footage of stuff and it looks so rough, it's
filming a TV.
It's a kinescope, which is just a fancy way to say they turned a camera at a TV.
Yeah.
And this also got them out of having to do it twice because they would have to do it once for the East Coast and the Midwest and then again for the West Coast.
Replay it off the kinescope.
So anyway, they ended up owning the rights to I Love Lucy.
Dang.
And then started their own TV production studio.
Desilu
Productions. Which then
Is that still around?
No, but Desilu Productions gave you Make Room for Daddy, which was then changed to the Danny Thomas Show, which was a huge hit, ran for 12 years, got rebooted in the 70s as Make Room for Granddaddy. Like, that's how popular that show was.
Okay.
Like, and then that Make Room for Daddy had a spinoff called The Andy Griffith Show, which did okay for itself.
Desilu
Productions then produced Star Trek. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they were very.
So, were they still seeing residuals from every other Star Trek that comes out after that?
I don't know where the rights are today. Like, they might have been sold off or whatever, but.
Dang.
They were very forward thinking in that regard. So
that's impressive. When did she die? It was a long time ago, right?
I'm gonna say the late '80s
early
nineties.
All right, it was that long ago. Let's see. Now that I'm on the closer to 40 to 30, it wasn't that long ago.
So let's see. She died in 1989.
Okay.
Okay.
And it's like my phone is like, too slimmed at the age of .. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Make the font a little smaller. 77.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. You know,
but
then you
she had a show on CBS like practically nonstop for like 30 years. Because I Love Lucy ran, and then when that was over, it flipped to
the Lucy show. I did not like the Lucy show.
And then when that was over, it flipped to Here's Lucy.
Oh, was that like a variety show?
No, it was like sitcom.
Like she Mary Tyler Moore.
She worked at a bank or some.
Okay. I did not like those. I Love Lucy was great. Yeah. I could never get into the future ones. When they were in color, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not that I had anything to do with it, you know, but they just
Superman
weren't...
was on her show. That's the first I Love Lucy I ever saw.
Right. And only Reeves. Probably.
But she even
I used to watch that.
Did
you? Yeah,
they even
that.
Tried to bring Lucy back in the 80s. She had a short lived sitcom just called Lucy. And it was like she moves into an apartment with her grandkids or some.
Dang, because
like
as she died in 89, she must have been up there. Grandma Lucy.
Yeah. So anyway, shameless plugs. Don't forget we were doing those.
Wow.
We
came out of a review into that.
Yeah. Don't forget League of Show Sharers. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. If you could join the League of Show Sharers, that's the group. That would be great. And you can share an episode and actually become a real life League of Show Sharer member. People who were kind enough to share an episode this week: Chris Valls, Travis Tewitt, Chris Magic Man, Ralph Tribble, Lane Levanway, Heather Sachs, Edward Fairfax, Tammy Sherman Powers, Julianne Jordan, Gabriel Lugo, Cinema Recall, Minorities Report, Spoiler Piece Theater, Vertigay 314, Colby Mack, Geek to Me Radio, Chris Williams, Chris Wilson, Ronnie Castle, Feel and Film, Mike and Oscar, Ryan Terry from the Forza Crowd Podcast, In Session Film, Invasion of the Remake, Binge Movies, and Matt Neglia. So thank you very much for
sharing.
Did
you mention Chris Magic Man?
I did.
You did?
Thanks
for
listening.
I'm glad we got him in there, because he said he's been doing the weird
Facebook hasn't been like letting me see everyone who shares episodes, so I don't know what that's about.
We know there's a lot of people that share them, and we apologize if we don't read your name, because we like to give that recognition.
Totally.
But don't stop sharing if you don't hear your name. One, it will probably come back when they update something, but two, even if we don't see it, your friends on your timeline are seeing it.
Yeah.
So you're sharing the show, and it really does help a lot to keep, you know, growing the show.
It's weird, because like some of these people are like, they're like, I am also Facebook friends with them, so I shouldn't be blocked.
You're not seeing it,
and I'm still, it won't, it
That's
like
weird.
When I click on it to see it, doesn't it like gives you a drop down of who shared it, and it like stops at like six people, and then it goes and more.
Right.
And you can't, and there's no
you
way
to click the and more.
I can't click the and more anymore. So
Marianne and the rest.
Yeah, I already went down the I Love Lucy rabbit hole.
We better talk about
me down
movie.
The Gilligan's Island rabbit hole. Okay,
right. Sit right back. Yeah. Calm yourself.
So anyway, Nightmare Alley.
There's a line with Guillermo del Toro where I have I have not enjoyed his stuff. Hmm. We are kind of the only movie reviewers / critics who didn't like Shape of Water. That was just us. Everybody else loved that movie. I didn't really enjoy Crimson Peak. Like, that was kind of meh.
That was pretty critically down the middle, I think.
Is that the submarine movie?
No, that's...
What was it,
Tom? I don't think so. That's the haunted house movie. You're thinking of Crimson Tide.
Oh. Thought that was the football movie. I'm awesome.
No, yeah.
But this is I really enjoyed this. Like,
this is my favorite Guillermo del Toro movie.
This is unlike
of all
any
time?
Yes.
This is like the least Guillermo del Toro movie Guillermo has ever del Toro'd. It's not a del Toro movie.
I think it's because of his wife.
Huh?
He married a film historian, and I think she like co-wrote the movie or whatever.
Oh.
And honestly, my biggest problem with Guillermo del Toro movies is I think the stories are kind of awful. And I think
because visually there's no arguing.
Absolutely,
that
they
he's
look
an incredible.
They look great, and we've talked about this before about how maybe there are some directors that shouldn't be directors, that they should be, you know,
cinematographers
or DPs.
I don't know. His early stuff is pretty good.
Blade 2, I think that's my favorite of the Blade franchises.
But Kronos and
Kronos is
Pan's
good.
Labyrinth, like his early stuff
I mean, Pan's Labyrinth was pretty to look at. I thought it was a bit of a snooze. Mm. I never cared for the Hellboy movies.
Those felt like a
Batman 66 version of Hellboy.
What's the bug one they did after Kronos?
Is it called Bug?
No.
That was the William Friedkin movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
the Orphanage. That's something of the Orphanage.
Well, let's see here. Let me just pull up the old IMDb, as we probably should have. did we mention Hellboy?
Yeah, because I said I didn't like it.
Oh, why don't you like anything, Tom?
Kronos, Mimic.
Mimic. The one where
the Devil's Backbone, Blade 2, Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy 2. I didn't realize Pan's Labyrinth was that deep into the run. Like I thought that's what got him Hellboy. That's how I remember that in my head.
Too.
Yeah. And then Hellboy 2, Pacific Rim, which again was meh for me. Crimson Peak didn't see.
I thought the original Pacific Rim, we didn't all like that. That was just big dumb
no,
fun.
No, I think we liked
I
it.
I wanted it to be funner.
Two was horrible. And
two
we
was
all agreed,
awful.
But
bad.
One, I thought we like, all were just like, it's him in the bathtub hitting his toys together.
I like the idea of it, but it didn't. It's not something I would ever watch again.
Okay.
It's literally him in the bathtub because that entire movie is in the nighttime rain.
Yeah. Oh.
That whole movie is in the nighttime.
And then I did not see Crimson Peak. And
it was not great.
And then I actively
Shape
hated
of water
Shape of Water.
Is, ugh. So. The only thing that's good about that movie is the makeup on the creature from the
Michael
Black
Shannon.
Movie. Oh, yeah. He's all right. But like the creature effect for him was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Because it's all practical, which I think is great. But this, like, and also Bradley Cooper, I think, has become one of my favorite actors.
He's really
like,
good.
I didn't realize it until I'm watching this, and I was like,
oh, come on. A Star is Born. He was great in A Star is Born. Like,
absolutely.
Great.
But I see his name, and I'm like, oh, that'll be fun. But after this, I'm like, when I see his name, that's kind of something I'm going to need to see.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Like, now it's it sells tickets now.
Yes.
For you.
He will sell a ticket for me. Like, if they're Bradley Cooper, he's my Green Lantern for real.
It's weird.
Like, if they get that guy a payday, he's your Hal Jordan.
Yeah. Coming from The Hangover, Wedding Crashers, bad guy, you know, Hangover, these kind of roles where he's the jerky, smarmy guy.
Yeah.
It's like, that guy can act. I mean,
I first noticed Bradley Cooper
inside the actor's studio asking questions to James Lipton, like one of his first credits.
I first noticed Bradley Cooper on a CW show called Jack and Bobby.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
And it was. It only ran.
Is that supposed to be the Kennedys?
No, and that's what part of why it failed is because it confused people.
We've had this conversation before. So,
but it was about a kid who grows up to be president, and it would exist in two timelines. But they always played coy as to which one of the brothers grew up to be president. So was kind of like, which one's going to be president? I don't know. And
the one named Jack,
and he played. He dated the mother. But the mother was like probably in her 40s and he was like supposed to be like 22. So there was a big age difference.
Oh, sure.
And so it wasn't sure like how that. And I really think that he was supposed to have like two episodes and be gone. And they kept bringing him back because he was so likable.
Was he on Alias?
I think so.
I didn't watch that.
I believe he was.
That's the best. But yeah, like Kevin, you're exactly right. Is he was like the jerk stuffed shirt bad guy in Wedding Crashers, and then he was kind of like the cool douchey best
bro
friend,
jerk and
bro jerk, but like the Heart of Gold bro jerk. But now he's turned that whole thing around with Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle and A Star is Born.
Yeah.
What was the one where he's the chef? Is it just called Chef?
No, that was one called Chef was Jon Favreau.
Jon Favreau. But he's in a movie where he's like a.
Yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
And
he's in a movie where he's John Peters, and that is.
You
need to see
that.
Licorice pizza. Seriously.
Burnt was the name of that movie.
Oh, okay. Okay. And in this, like, he's magnetic. He's so good on screen. And when he has this bonkers character arc. And when you get to the end and you're just like, oh, man, I feel terrible walking out of this movie.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So this is a remake of a 1947 movie that's based on.
Did you watch the original?
I've never seen the original.
I did see the original. Yeah. This is a very faithful adaptation. And maybe because Del Toro, if he's married to a film historian and she helped write it, you know, she's not one to stray too far from, you know, the film aspect of it. It doesn't seem like an adaptation of the book unless they're both extremely faithful. But I mean, if you watch the original movie, the beats are very similar. Now, they
does it end the same way?
No. This the original hangs around for a scene too long. This one ends at the second to last scene. And the original, they try to give a happy ending.
Oh, they try to.
No, they give a happy ending, which is like.
Gotcha.
So this is so much more impactful and meaningful. They ended it there.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole arc. Like, that supports everything that you've seen and everything this guy has done. And, you know, it just. this is a great ending. And I saw that one. I'm like, oh, it is the same. And they're like, next day, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, what? What is this? Like, it's like the next day at the thing. So, or that later that evening. But anyway.
Hollywood was weird about dark endings back then.
You didn't want to leave someone.
They didn't like them. Yeah. And so you didn't get them very often.
So, yeah, it was just that one tech. Now, again,
this one.
Yeah, but I mean, now I, you know, shame on me. I didn't read the book end that way. I think it would be, Tom can probably do some research. He's good at multitasking. Yeah. But like, did the book and the movie end the same way? It would be interesting because maybe the original was super faithful. But to me, it seems like a movie tag. I bet the book was dour. That's just gonna be my guess. We'll see.
Books are more likely to be that way.
And I bet the movie, the studio was like, let's see if we can give them a, well, maybe things will be okay. But so let's start off the movie. So they start off with this mystery, right? And
yes.
So
yeah, he's in like this shack basically, and he's dragging a wrapped up body into a hole, and he sets it on fire, and the house burns down, and he being Bradley Cooper kind of walks off in the distance.
So you're like, so right from the beginning, you're like, what the hell is this? They throw you into that, and then you're like, who is this? Is it future? Is it past? Right? Yeah. So you don't know. You question. Like, to me, I was thinking maybe that's a flash forward. Like, in my head, you know, trying to figure it out before the movie's over, I'm like, ooh, is he going to kill someone we are going to meet? And that's a future thing, and you're supposed to think it's his past. But it ends up, you know, spoilers. It is
the show.
Right.
Yeah. Also, the book does end the same way.
Ooh. As which one?
As this one, or
as the movie? Like this movie, it doesn't appear from the Wikipedia synopsis. Yeah. It does not have the tact on happy.
Okay, good. Okay, that's what I'm thinking. And Del Toro, and I feel like that's something to where he's like not going to change that, and because I think Del Toro, you know, his movies are. You can read a lot of things into them, right? So like when you look at Shape of Water, I mean, I know that we all didn't love it, but obviously there's a lot of people that do, and
I don't think we liked it.
Well, there's a lot of meaning behind it, though, right? So, I mean, his movies they say a lot, and there's a lot of things that you can take from them. And so I feel like the type of filmmaker he is with this movie, he's not going to try to give you hope because he just told you this whole guy's arc and how everything catches up with him.
It's interesting because he's not a bad guy. Right, like he didn't do anything that was.
He doesn't start off bad, but he gets.
I don't even think he's bad.
But
until
technically literally does start off horrible. That's the thing. So
that's fair.
We don't know.
But
in the end, once you know, you're like, oh no, he's horrible. He is a horrible person.
Yeah.
And so that's why the ending is so fitting.
Because I didn't think he was horrible.
No,
I thought
he murders his dad and burns the house down. He's horrible.
I mean,
that's like not even opinion. Like he murders his father, Joe. He leaves his father is sick on his deathbed. The window is left open, freezing. He tortures his dad. And then burns his house down.
That's fair.
Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, that's, I'm...
No, yeah, I get it.
You can't, like...
I'm just thinking, like, I mean, when we kind of hear, like, the motivation, it's not like he... It's difficult, right? Like, in one world, you can see where he is. He's an old man. He's dying anyway. And apparently he does not, you know, maybe I'm writing the movie for him. He was really awful to Bradley Cooper. And... this is kind of like the middle finger to the old man for the way that Bradley Cooper was raised.
Well, yeah, any problem.
I'm not saying it's right.
Right. That's the question, right? So, yeah, he probably was awful to him. And so that's probably why Bradley Cooper turned out the way he is. I mean, of course, but that's the moral dilemma is it's like, well, does that make it right to do that to someone else?
Sure,
you know, maybe you just leave and say good luck on your own. Can you get out of bed and feed yourself and whatever? But, like, it's the way he did it.
No, he does actively open a window in frigid temperatures and takes the blanket.
To let him die and he... You know, burned the body once he was dead, right? So he stuck around and let his dad freeze to death after being tortured and then burned the place down, right?
Yeah.
It's not like he shot him and put him in the hole. Like, you die from cold, like hypothermia. And yeah. So that's the thing, though. So this movie, but you don't know that, right? So you're watching this movie and you've got charismatic Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
And you're rooting for him. And you're like, man, this guy is smart. He's just trying to make it. And he ends up at this circus and he gets a job, a crappy job, and he climbs the ranks and learns things. And man,
see,
he's skilled.
This is what I thought is the way that he started to like integrate himself into the circus. I thought the circus, like somebody, like I thought he was trying to take down the circus because he starts to buddy up with Rooney Mara, and he starts to like kind of pull her away, and he starts to do all these different things where it feels like he's starting to maybe start to break this I mean, can we say freak show? Because that's what this is, right?
I mean, that's what they would have called it back then.
Yeah, this is the classic. Right? This is the classic 1940s freak show.
Freak show.
You've got the bearded lady and the small people and the
and like everything's
the,
a gimmick.
The geeks. I mean, it's the it is the freak show. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is a circus. That, they have other things, strong men, but I mean, these are the circuses that had freak shows.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So he goes to see the geek and
Will James Enstall plays... from Geek to Me Radio. Oh, different kind. Okay.
Different kind. Yeah.
Okay.
Willem Dafoe is kind of the guy who runs the show, and he says, if you want to watch him eat this chicken, like, you got to pay an extra quarter. So everybody's pitching in a quarter, and Bradley Cooper isn't a big fan of the show and kind of like ducks out, and he runs into Ron Perlman and another little person. And then he gets, does he get hit in the head? Is that right? And they take him, like, it's, or he said, oh, he, Willem Dafoe. What does he do here?
Well, it's a big storm, and he helps out, and
they give
him some shelter.
He
gives
him a job.
Yeah. Yeah. And he pays him for his work. He's like, but, I saw you in there.
Watching the geek show.
Yeah.
But he ends up sticking around with the circus, and he, like, you know, he starts working with them. He has
He's a drifter. He has nothing. He burnt his house down, as we see, and we don't know why.
Yeah, he's got a radio. That's it.
Presuming that that was the past, which it ended up being. It's like, well, yeah, he's got nothing else, so he's just trying to figure out something. And so he falls in with the circus and makes a little life for himself. You know, he picks up on things really well. He's smart. He starts working with Xena, who's played by Toni Collette.
Toni Collette, yeah.
And her husband, Pete. Yeah, who is Pete played by?
You would recognize.
I know him. David Strathairn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's great.
Yeah, he's really good in this. I thought he was...
I will say, there is not a bad performance in this movie. This is an actor's movie.
This cast, because we didn't run it down, but I was going to be like, you know, Cate Blanchett, Toni Collette, who we mentioned, Willem Dafoe, Richard Jenkins, Rooney Mara, Ron Perlman, Mary Steenburgen, David Strathairn, Clifton Collins Jr. shows up, Tim Blake Nelson... you know, just scrolling down here, it's like there are tons of people in this movie, and you know, and get Del Toro's a guy that can assemble a cast like that.
Yeah.
And for this story, having this caliber of actors, like, I mean, there are some great performances.
This is one of my favorite movies of the year. Yeah, I positively love this movie.
Oh man, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I love it the more I think about it.
Yeah,
you know?
It sticks with you. It sticks to your ribs. And
I liked it, but I didn't love it like you did. But I kept thinking about it and then watching the original, and I'm like, man, he did a really good job remaking this.
Yeah.
So it's built.
And it's weird because it's called Nightmare Alley, so I spent the first like 45 minutes waiting for it to turn into a horror movie.
Yep.
And a supernatural. Is that? And I think that's a little bit of why it just didn't sit right with me, because I'm like, this is Del Toro. What's he going to do with it?
Right.
Maybe with that third eye. What's
right, totally. And then it was a click for me, like, oh, this is just good old-fashioned film noir.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in.
And he's a con man.
Yeah.
It's a con movie.
Right.
So it's like, at the end of the day, he's just a con man. I mean, very smart.
And I get that the story's always been called Nightmare Alley. I really think they should have changed the name.
100%
agree. I think it set it up, because I started watching this with my stepdaughter because she loves horror movies, and I was like, oh, it's a horror movie. I think you'll love it. And she's just like, this is so boring.
Yeah.
But
they lost a lot of people that wouldn't go see a horror movie.
Yeah.
This did horrible
put Nightmare Alley and then you put his name on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Del Toro's Nightmare Alley. Yeah.
Guillermo Del Toro's Nightmare Alley.
Yeah, I think they really did themselves a disservice. I agree, because the movie is very good.
This is going to be in like 2 years. You'll see all those articles where it's like, this forgotten Del Toro movie is number one on Netflix.
Right.
It's, you know.
It's a shame. And I know it had some tough competition. This is out when Spider-Man's out. You know, obviously we're still in a pandemic, but people that would love this movie are not turning up for it, I think, because they don't know. They just and it's a shame, because it is really...
And I think the people that love this movie, they don't love Del Toro, and so they're
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Like, the people that would love a movie like this are probably would not gravitate towards his film.
His name resume. Isn't selling them tickets,
right.
But if you give this a chance,
if they might have been better not marketing it as a Del Toro.
which is like it's impossible.
And I don't even mean that to be like crappy towards him, but just like I think that a lot of the audience that would love a movie like this, like, he's the opposite of what they would expect to deliver a movie like this. And you don't get a lot of movies like this.
No, this felt like like the way it was shot and the way the dialogue is delivered, it felt like a 1940s movie.
But
like,
did a great job capturing that.
Yeah, really everything did. Down to the can't like because the camera doesn't move a lot, which I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like in that time there wasn't a lot of big sweeping shots or lots of camera
they were
movement.
Expensive, you know,
right? So you had to do it on the cheap.
Yeah.
And that had this had like, you know, there's, you know, when we get to Kate Blanchett and we get to see her office, like her office is really big, like the set for that office. And they kind of do like a forced perspective where like they're in the back of the office and they're letting you see everything and see how big it is. But there isn't a lot of camera movement. It's just it's all focused on the performances and everybody delivers.
There's a lot of really good actors in this. And so, yeah, the performances carry it, but it's a beautiful looking movie. The camera work, it does look great. And you know, the color and the lighting and everything, the atmosphere of this movie, it's excellent. And that's Del Toro. I mean, he knows how to make a movie look incredible. I think even for people that didn't like Crimson Peak, I mean, they all admitted though, they're like, it's a gorgeous looking movie. It's he definitely knows how to fit a movie. That's his thing.
Yeah.
So he gets in with these people.
With Pete and Zora, is that right?
Zena, Toni Collette.
Warrior Princess?
Yes.
Yes. And we find out that Pete was a mentalist, and he got a little too deep into the world, and he has taken to the bottle. He's a little bit, not a little bit, he's a drunk. And he's to the point in his drinking where he cannot function. Like, he just can't. And he's flubbing up on Toni Collette's show, like she, you know, they have this whole gimmick rigged, and he can't.
It's a
get
coded back and forth where they do cold readings, and they'll hold up an item. And
well,
then
it wasn't coded at this point.
No, this is
he's
like,
doing the mirror, the trick.
Paper.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's later on, which is cool. That's what he used to do, but he's too drunk to do that. But he was so good because they had this amazing code. But Bradley Cooper starts like helping out with the regular thing. But as he gets closer with Pete, and Pete kind of takes him under his wing and explains his old act and sees that someone's interested in it. So he starts teaching him little by little. And then Bradley Cooper gets
but he
the
won't
idea.
Give him the book, which I think is cool. Like he's got this book.
Yeah. But he's like. But he's a con man, as we come to find out. I mean, that's what he's good at is, you know, winning people over, using them, getting what he wants. And so he's like, well, yeah, I could just do this. I could use this code. I'm not a drunk and I can, you know, make this my act. And so eventually.
So are we to believe that Bradley Cooper and Toni Collette have a relationship?
Well,
like she definitely jerks him off in a bathtub.
I mean, they do. Yeah, they do.
Because doesn't Rooney Mara say she's like, what about?
Right. Well, yeah. And he's a con man. So he says, oh, no, we're just friends. But like, no, they have a sexual relationship.
OK.
He's lying to her to get what he wants. That, but... Yeah. And in the original movie, it's the same way. Like the main character wants to Stan wants to, you know, kind of promises her things and says, oh, well, I could. The whole thing is like, well, he hears from the Rooney Mara character in the original that there's this code. She knows a lot about the code.
Oh,
and then he talks
to
Zena and says like, hey, we could do this. Why don't you, you know, Pete's a drunk and keeping you down kind of thing, paraphrasing. And he, you know, we could use this code. We could sell it and start a new life and do all this. And so she's keen to that idea. And so he pretty much steals their those two leave Pete and use the coded thing.
Oh, I see.
And they get big, but then he notices the Rooney Mara character, and then all of a sudden Xena's old news. And
yeah,
you know, he,
so it's interesting. Okay, so
he steals the code for himself to do with Rooney Mara.
I was a little confused because we get the scene with Willem Dafoe where he shows like he's got two different batches of alcohol, and one is like okay to drink and the other is not okay to drink.
Yeah, one is wood alcohol.
Does he purposely, so that we get a scene where
for Xena's show she uses fire and they burn the card so that once they steal the note, which patrons are coming, they're writing something on a card, putting it in an envelope. Pete is then supposed to read it, put it on a little tablet, you know, an old fashioned, you know, piece of paper, and then through the fortune teller crystal ball, she's able to look down and see what he's written. But for the show part of it, she burns the letter. So it's like, well, I can't read it. It's in this envelope. It's never been opened, supposedly, and now it's burnt. It doesn't exist.
Right.
So she uses fire in her show. Bradley Cooper purposefully gives it to Pete and kills him because he's a horrible person and he wants to steal his code. So there's a third thing where when he's explaining the geek show,
yes,
Willem Dafoe says, he explains how, later on in the movie, you know, how do you get a geek? Well, this is how you do it. And so he, you know, finds a drunk and offers them a place to sleep and booze. And then he puts opium in the drink. So like they're really addicted to it. And they find it like they can't leave because they have to get right. that.
They have to get that specific. That'd be basically gets them addicted to heroin.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
That's exactly what he does. And then it gets the geek to do it every once. But I thought, so like to your point that he's an awful human being.
Yeah.
I thought he gave Pete the poison, not the, like the bad alcohol, so that he would die. And then he could leave with the book. Because there's a whole scene where Bradley Cooper is like flipping through this book. And Pete kind of snaps up and wakes up and grabs him by the hand.
Yeah.
And says, what? He's like, I'm sorry. I was just looking at it. He's like, you can't do that. He's like, yeah, that's mine. And it's too dangerous. And then he gives them the wood alcohol and he dies.
Yeah. So he
gets the book.
That's the other thing.
But so it's a little ambiguous as to whether or not that was purposeful.
Correct.
Yeah, I guess at this point. But
right. I think looking back, but at this point, yeah, we don't know for sure if that was deliberate.
Yeah. When I originally watched the movie, I thought he was just a drunk and drank one too many. Like, yeah. I didn't read it that way until I saw all the things he did. And then I'm like, oh, he murdered him to steal his code.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what happened.
Which is why
it's presented in a way that like you could read it either way.
Totally.
Yeah.
They're rolling through town and here comes Jim Beaver, who you would recognize from Deadwood. He was on Supernatural. He was on all kinds of stuff as like this town sheriff. He's going to shut down the freak show and Bradley Cooper kind of hits him with some of the mentalism, and gets him to not do it. So Stan saves the circus and doesn't get it shut down. And he explains how he did it. And he was just like, you know, he had like a lift in his shoe. So I assume he had polio. So he's doing exactly what a con man / mentalist would do. And he works the mark, basically.
And meanwhile, Molly, played by Rooney Mara, is seeing all this, and she's becoming more and more infatuated with him. You know, she's there.
And he's made it very clear that he is into her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And finally, they decide to leave. They decide to leave together. They're going to take this act on the road.
Not without a nice punch from Ron Perlman.
I mean, who's one guy I don't want to get punched by?
Yeah.
Even, like, in movies or real life. I don't know, thank you. That guy looks like he has, like...
Yeah.
The hands like the thing.
So Ron Perlman, who plays Bruno, is very protective of Molly. He basically took her in. He's her surrogate father, if you will, and wants to make sure no one will hurt her. And he's seen a lot of people come and go through the circus. And I think he has a keen, like he's not fallen for Stan's act. He knows that he's not a good guy. And so he's like, you're not going to leave with her. And then she eventually is just like, no, I love him. And well, you know what I mean? And so he's just like, okay, if you hurt her, I'm coming for you. But yeah, he reads them. And it's interesting, in the original movie, it seemed like they were in a relationship. It wasn't a father daughter thing. Basically Stan
stole his girlfriend.
Gotcha. Yeah. So it's interesting how they changed that dynamic. I liked it in this one. I mean, it wasn't weird. It just, I mean, cause I had, since I saw this one first, it was a little weird, but then it's like, well, but that's not how it was in the original. You know what I mean? Like, so it wasn't a weird thing. It was just for me jarring.
I will say there was a moment where I thought the way Ron Perlman plays it, that he was in love with her, but because he made the promise to the old man, like he wouldn't act on it.
Or he's just too old for he could, you know, maybe there was something like, but it's pretty much supposed to be a fatherly protective.
No,
kind
totally,
of thing.
Totally. But, so we flash forward 5 years,
something.
They've taken the, you know, they've taken the act on the road. They are very successful. They're working two, you know, the big deal is like we're doing two shows a night.
They've worked their way up to a theater. You know, they left and now he's got his own headline. You know, he probably opened for people and
he was probably working the vaudeville circuit with him, I guess. And then
he's got a sweet mustache.
Yeah. And then like, you know, you'd work vaudeville and then you'd work your way up the bill and eventually like you would be able to spin off if you were successful.
Yeah.
And do your own headlining act.
And that's the thing that Pete and Xena used to, I don't know if in this one, if they, implicitly say it, but in the original they do that they used to be a huge vaudeville act.
Right.
And then Pete got drunk and then they had to just do the circus thing. So, you know, Pete's issues were definitely holding their act back, and obviously he had a problem and didn't get the help he needed, so it's not like not totally blaming him, but they were a huge act, like they had potential, basically. They were very talented, and this was a huge thing, and that's why Stan sees the potential in this. And so it's interesting, in the original they talk about getting Pete help, and in this one I don't remember them really caring too much about getting
Pete help. Was giving him the poison booze.
Right. That's pretty much was.
So this is where they have a run-in with Kate Blanchett, where we find out that she is kind of, she's trying to suss Stan and Molly out and try to prove that they are fakes. And Stan has gotten so good at this, we think, that he even tricks Kate Blanchett, right? Like the deal is that Rooney Mara will use coded language to tell Stan what is in front of him without anybody knowing, right? So it's just certain words mean certain letters and things. It's carny speak, basically. Can I say that too? Is that okay?
I think so.
Okay. So
we've said worse.
That's true. Yeah.
What's interesting about this is that this is where you can read into it. Well, I mean, at this point in the movie, it's like, well, is there a supernatural element, right? Because Kate Blanchett has him dead to rights. She says, I know they're using a code. I'm going to trick them. And Bradley Cooper just completely reads her and tells her everything. And there's no way he could have known.
Yeah, he's just that good.
But in the end.
Also, there's Pete kind of says, you don't do this certain type of show.
You don't do a spook show. Like,
all right.
That's what they called it.
But that's
right. Like, like spook, ghosts. Like ghosts. Yeah.
I know.
But like basically like don't use these powers to convince people that there's really ghosts and magic.
Right. Because, don't cross that line.
Like that's uncool.
Well, and he also says, don't believe your own gimmick, right?
Yeah.
Like don't, like the problem is that Bradley Cooper has gotten so good that I think even he is
starts to think like,
I do have the power.
This isn't a skill. This is a power that I have.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is he gets too big and too confident, and you know he breaks the rules that Pete has set out.
And even Rooney Mara is like, look, we should not be doing this. Like, this is not okay. And she kind of goes along with it when we get to the judge, but once Bradley Cooper realizes how much money he could be making. Of course, as a con man will do, he keeps stepping it up and gets himself into a situation that he can't get out of.
Like, he has a great life at this point. He has, he's headlining a show. He has this great act. He's making tons of money. He has a wife that loves him. He has everything that he should or could need.
He's got the world by the balls.
Yeah. And it's never enough for him. And that's the type of person he is. And so he needs more and more. Kate Blanchett comes along and he sees her intellect and also as another means to whatever the next, it's not an ends, but he can make more money. So he's going to try
to level up,
try to use her. And so he leaves behind this person that loves him in this great life, you know, for Kate Blanchett, just like he left Xena for Molly. And it's this continuous cycle you see of greed and power and status symbols that nothing will ever be enough for Stan. And you know, he flies too close to the sun eventually.
He gets in with this judge, and the judge lost his son in, I guess, World War I. Is that right? Because I think they're saying that like World War II is just about to start.
World War II is about to. Yeah, this is like 1940, 1939.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm assuming they lost their son in World War I, is what I took it as. And it's Mary Steenburgen, who I couldn't believe I saw her in a movie.
That was great. I'm like
the last thing I saw her in.
I was like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And he's not being a jerk about it. He's just kind of, initially you think he's just trying to give them comfort, as to, you know, their son is with them and he knows that you're sorry or that you love him, blah, blah, blah. But the line he delivers is that he, you know, that the son knows someday, we will all be together again. And that you think it gives Mary Steenburgen this level of comfort and she's okay. And she can accept the fact that he is gone. that's not entirely true.
This kind of plays out. It reminded me of like the monkey's paw, you know, like he's giving people their wishes and they're ending horribly. And then again, that's why I thought this was going to go supernatural and why I kept building up. It's my own expectations, but I'm waiting for Del Toro to keep dropping this supernatural because it looked like everyone he quote unquote helped was dying and going to end up terrible, you know, and I thought that it was going to be something like that. But I think it's really interesting.
And Richard Jenkins was also in Shape of Water. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, you hadn't seen him since Step Brothers. I was like, he was in Shape of
Mary Steenburgen.
No, Mary Steenburgen.
Oh, I thought you said. I thought you.
No, meant, we're not. Yeah, we're not to him yet.
That's hilarious that they're both in Step Brothers, though.
Yeah,
totally.
It's funny. So
but she was also in Last Man on Earth, which a TV show.
Oh, was
movie,
she?
But yeah, she had. Yeah, she had a reoccurring. She was a regular on Last Man on Earth. Which
I couldn't keep watching because Katie hated that show, so we had to stop watching.
You should leave her.
She could. She just couldn't stand what's her face. Kirsten Schaal.
Oh, gosh.
She couldn't. She just that kind of comedy where the person is just always ruining the other person's life and like irritating them and stuff. Like, she just can't stand like that type of. So I was like, you know, I was totally into. I like both them and the premise. I'm like, totally. This is interesting. And then I never just had the time to on my own watch it. So someday, but
this was a fun theater experience because I went to the Chase, which is a smaller. Like boutique style theater, and it wasn't very full. It was, I would say, about a fourth full. Mm-hmm. And we get to this next scene where the judge and his wife are sitting at breakfast, and she's makes this comment, and she was like, you know, I just kept thinking about what he said about us being about, you know, all of us being together again, and I could hear a woman on the other side of the theater audibly go, "Oh no."
Yeah. Well, that's so interesting that like you give people. You never know how people are going to interpret or take things. Like he gave this comfort and the way you read it on face value is like, oh, they're comforted.
Right.
We'll
sure.
see them again, whatever. But that person can take and go like, let's expedite that.
Right.
Because I don't want to wait to see them again. Yeah. So it's, I think that's
which is why the guy says, don't do a spook show.
Yeah.
Right.
It's fascinating. Yeah. So the warnings are all there. All, you know, all the foreshadowing is there and he tells them these things and Bradley Cooper, because of the person he is, he just keeps pushing it, needs more and more and more. Doesn't listen to the people with the experience, the people that have been ruined by certain indulging in certain things. And so it just keeps getting worse and worse. But yeah, I really thought that was interesting and it threw me for a loop because I didn't
see
that coming.
It's a good jump. It's a good gag.
You just flash back to them, and I was like, where's this going? I remember them. Okay. You know, and then that happens, and that's where I go like, oh, crap. Everyone he quote-unquote helps is going to start dying off.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's kind of – he only helps – well, helps. Yeah. I use the term loosely. Two people. And, unfortunately, both of those don't make it. So, like, the judge's wife shoots him in the face – and then she turns the gun and it's not like a, you know, to the temple, it's like straight on to the back, you know, to the front of the face. And it was Del Toro obviously has an eye for gore, which he's done before, and these are two really, you know, good little, it looked like it was probably CG, it doesn't matter.
This movie, again, as far as effects and everything, I mean, Del Toro's great at that. Nothing in this movie stood out to me like, oh, that's gross CG. Like,
no,
I don't know, it all felt very good to me. But I don't know.
So because he helped the judge puts him in contact with like this. They don't really say what he did, but I took it as like he was like a spy for the government.
I thought he was maybe a mobster or something. But what I took it as is that he was basically a serial killer. I thought he was killing young women.
Oh, that's interesting.
I didn't take him as a serial killer.
Maybe.
Is he Jack the Ripper?
I don't know. No, I just it's interesting. I thought that maybe that wasn't.
There's a theory that he's an American. That's why they couldn't.
Oh, okay. But yeah, I mean, it's vague. I mean, they don't explain it to you. But in my thought, I was thinking that he did not only kill one woman. I was thinking that he doesn't.
Like he said that he hurt. We should say that. Bradley Cooper has to go through a lot of rigmarole to get to this guy, right? He's got to go through the big heavy from Mindhunter. I can't think of that guy's name, but he was in Mindhunter. He was in Lights Out. You'd recognize him from other stuff.
Yeah, Holt McCallany.
He had like the most Irish sounding name too, and I couldn't.
But you've seen him. He's one of the guys in Fight Club that Brad Pitt enlists, you know, as part of his Project Mayhem.
He looks like he would be like a heavy for a mob.
He's always, he's like the right hand man, bodyguard type guy. You know, he's in a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Lights Out, I do recommend that. That was a good little show on FX.
He was in Justice League as Burglar. I think he's the guy in the Snyder Cut that's on the roof that in the first scene or something that Batman
that
confronts on the roof. Remember, it was totally cut from the original one, but in the Snyder one, I think he has that.
Initially, we thought he was Harvey Bullock.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, so he has to get through this guy, and then when he finally gets to.
But you don't see him as like a mobster type with that kind of protection. It didn't seem like he was just a businessman.
But he seemed so like wealthy and open about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But
that's why I thought he worked for the government.
Yeah. Or maybe he's like a bootlegger, but now that it's legal, he pivoted.
But he has all that money from
right.
Something about him seemed he act to me like I read it like a mobster.
Yeah, definitely nefarious.
I can see that for sure.
Yeah.
Especially when he's walking through, like, he walks through, like, the garden that he built with protection.
Yeah.
Like, the guy's always with him. Yeah.
Like, I really like this. And when I watched the original film, this character is not like this. He's just another socialite and just another mark for Stan. Like, he doesn't have a bodyguard.
Gotcha.
He doesn't seem that intimidating. I mean, this character is so different in this movie, and
yeah.
I love it. Like Richard Jenkins brings so much to this performance. It's a great performance.
He's a really good bad guy.
Yeah, he's super intimidating in this. Like he's an older guy, but he is so intimidating.
Yeah.
And then with the whole bodyguard thing, really amps that up. And the scene to get in with him, like none of that happens in the original, and this one has a much bleaker ending for that character because again there's not a bodyguard, so there's no one there shooting and chasing and getting ran over, like none of that's in it. So I think I really appreciate what they did with this, and I saw this one first, but still I went back and I was just like, okay, that he was just another character in that one, but this is a really good segment where he has to get in and use the information. So Cate Blanchett is a therapist, a psychoanalyst of some sort, and the reason why he wants to get in with her is because he knows that she records all her sessions, and he can basically use all the knowledge from her sessions to pretend like he's reading their minds or whatever, talking to the people that they've lost, but really he's just getting it from her. And so, you know, he has to do
he's working the con, like he's working her. He thinks he's working her.
Right.
Just getting that information. But yeah, he gets all this information and he has to take a lie detector test and he's failing it. And then he has to pull out a little info that suckers him in, lets him keep coming back.
Which he passes the detector test at this part because he knows it's truth, so he's not lying anymore or trying to make anything up. And this is again also where I'm just like, is he believing his own BS? You know, like he's passing the test, he's acting like some kind of, talking like some kind of minister or something, and talking about all the info he's gotten. And I'm just like, is this another part where you kind of see Bradley Cooper like living it, like the lie detector's not going off, is he believing his own or I think that's at least some kind of like a metaphor or something.
Totally. Well, because lie detectors are highly questionable anyway, but they don't work if you believe what you're saying, right? Like if you have some sort of psychosis and you believe aliens are hiding in your living room and they test you, it's what you believe. Even though it's still factually inaccurate.
Yeah. So at this point he's saying things that we know he's got information, but it also shows that he believes himself. And I think that he's at this point, he's gone from like thinking it's just grift.
He's gone down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, he's off the rails. So while all this is going on, he's developed this relationship with Cate Blanchett, and he adamantly has said, "I do not drink. I do not drink. I do not drink." And I thought, man, this scene here, I thought was so slick, where she stops offering him booze, she takes a drink of it, and then she kisses him, so that he gets the taste of the booze on his lips. And I was like, damn, like that at that moment, I was like, oh, you're effed.
That is
like
good.
She's working you and she has gotten you to drink. And it is. And he falls in, he immediately goes into drinking. Like he is always drinking from that moment on. Rooney Mara kind of said like the deal is that.
Oh, you know what? They in the original movie, see, Del Toro hides some things from you here, and I think it's really smart, or maybe his wife, her writing. They hide certain things that don't give away the ending or his fate if you haven't seen the original or read the book, which are great. In the original movie, when he first shows up to the circus and he sees the geek, he's talking to people about the geek, and he's like, who is that guy? Oh, he used to be a mentalist, but you know, but that doesn't matter. They kind of brush it aside, but basically foreshadowing that this guy was actually someone that had it together, was a mentalist, drink alcohol brought him down, and now look where he's at,
right?
Which is essentially Stan's entire path. But in this one, they implicitly say he doesn't drink. They don't mention anything about how someone could fall so far,
right?
And so they hide those things to where you don't pick it up on it until the end, and then you go back and watch it or discuss it, and you're like, dang, they dropped all these little clues.
Well,
and
when Willem Dafoe gives his speech as to how he gets the geek, and I was in my head, I'm like, that's coming back.
But like, also, how good is that guy though? Like, Dafoe is so good in this movie.
I will say that I was like, oh, he ends up being one. Yeah. Like that,
I'm with you.
I called that. I was like, and I still love this movie, but I was like, oh, that's where we're headed.
See,
like,
that's exactly where we're headed. You know, it made me like, I didn't like the Dafoe character. He's so good at being a bad guy, and he's such a scumbag the way that he lures people in and everything. Like, it really made me hate him, and it was like making me think, oh, well, Bradley Cooper's going to take his circus down or something. Like, to me, I just didn't read into it like that. I think it was clever how they like hit it, and you could see that Cooper was disgusted with, you know, with him and everything. And Dafoe was so smarmy and like taking such pride in the way he lures. Oh my God.
Like, I'm so smart.
Yeah. Like, it's like, oh, it's gross. And what a great performance. Like this and Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's so good.
At the same time, he's so good.
So yeah. So we find out that what Richard Jenkins, right? That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. What he wants to do is, if Bradley Cooper, I think, accidentally says, I can get her to show up.
Well, I don't think so. I think the guy, like, most people are happy with just these messages or whatever, but this guy, you know, he's going to tell you what he wants, and he's given Stan so much money at this point and keeps working with him. And he's like, enough of this BS. I don't know. I want to really communicate with her. Like, I want to talk to her. I don't want just a message. I want, you know, I want more. And he's like, you're going to deliver by this date. And that's where this character in this version of the movie isn't so intimidating and everything. Like, he's stuck.
Yeah.
Like, he basically knows that people that don't do what this guy wants end up disappearing, or, you know, like, they're
exactly.
So,
so he has to, Rooney Mara is out. She is out at this point. She doesn't want to do this. And he kind of says, like, look, we do this one last thing and we're out. Like, this, we'll have enough money to do whatever we want.
Well, she's getting ready to leave him, right? Like
she's getting on it. She's
At this point, it's far past like, not we're out. It's I'm leaving you either way. But like, she feels sorry for him. Like, she knows that basically his life depends on it. So she's like, I will do this one last thing, but then I'm out. Like,
I think she's
done.
Got a great line too, where she says, you know, you reach a point in, I don't know, they're sitting in the car and they had this conversation where she kind of says, you reach a point where you know that you can't do this anymore. And he was like, yeah, what are you talking? She's like, I've reached that point.
Well, and there's all
says we're done.
Yeah. And there's also this point that we didn't mention where like Xena shows back up. Ron Perlman shows up.
Yeah.
The old friends from the circus come to visit them and they see how successful they are and everything. And Xena brings out her tarot cards, which we saw earlier. And this is the same in the original movie. And she reads them and she ends up showing him the same card that Pete had. Like, she sees,
oh, is that what that was?
She sees Pete's demise, the flipped over, the hangman, the way that it is facing, it fell off the table, remember, in the beginning of the movie.
Sure.
She's like, that's a bad sign, blah blah blah. So she sees the same card for Stan, and then Stan is like, this is all BS, you know, this is an act, blah blah blah. And she's like, no, I really believe in this, and you know, we saw what happened to Pete, and now this is your card. And he blows up to them, get out of here. And Rooney Mara
turns the card around.
Yeah, he's like, well, no, I can,
I just changed it.
Yeah, like if it's facing this way, it's bad. Okay, well, I'll turn it the other way. And you know, this is Rooney Mara's family, and she really, you know, was excited to see them, and he kicks them out and acts like a jerk and everything. And she just realizes how horrible of a person he is, and you know, using everybody. She also found in his little code book or whatever a sketch of Kate Blanchett, so she knows that he's been infatuated with her and cheating on her, so she's done at this point. And and he's like,
she does come back to do the last show. And the deal is she's going, you know, they've got this time, she's gonna wear a wig and a dress and have like the same wounds that Dory, who is this you know, Richard Jenkins' wife at the time, she's gonna walk in the distance, he's gonna see her. He's going to, you know, Stan's going to make Richard Jenkins like drop to his knees and pray. And then Rooney Mara can run away and we're in the clear.
Yeah, his scam, his grift is that if you get Jenkins, his character, to apologize and, you know, ask for forgiveness, that he thinks he is going to help him, like he's quote unquote helped the other people, right?
Right.
By
right.
You know, clearing his conscience and letting him live a happy life, enjoy your money, and not be tormented by guilt and everything. But that's not enough for this guy. You know,
nope.
This guy's going to tell you what he wants. He, you know, doesn't want to just ask for forgiveness. He needs to apologize to her. He needs to touch her and you know, tell her how sorry
he is.
He
runs up to her and he wraps his arms around her, and Rooney Mara freaks out, reasonably so.
And he's like, who the hell are you?
He looks up and he looks up at her, and it's obviously not his wife.
In the original movie, the Molly just freaks out and is like, I can't do this. She blows it. The guy is like,
okay.
You know, okay, you know, apologizing, whatever. And she is just like, I can't do this, Stan. I can't do this. And the guy's like, what the hell? And they run off. That's it. There's no dramatic chase. There's no punching
there's no
or shooting
where,
or
Stan
cars.
Destroys
or,
oh gosh, the guy's
none
face.
Of that. Yeah, it's so much more dramatic and really impactful, to, literally, and, you know, for the movie in this part.
Stan freaks out and. I mean,
well, the guy is like calling for
his
security,
his
you know, he's calling to get help, you know, get over here, you know, and he wants to kill this guy. And so Stan starts pummeling
Stan
him,
smushes his face and kills him. Stan gets shot in the process, I think. And they run off and they, you know, they get out of the area, and Rooney Mara basically says, F you, I'm out.
Well,
and
he also says, move over, gets in the car. The security guy is shooting at him, and he puts it in reverse and runs him over.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He does, like, squish that guy, too.
And this is where I think, I know Rooney Mara was already done. Molly was already said, I'm leaving, I'm going back home, whatever, this is the last thing we do. But at this moment, when she gets out of the car, even though there's a dead guy and police on the way and whatever, she can't even be in the same car with this guy. Like,
yeah,
she's like, you're a murderer.
Right.
Yeah, I knew you were a bad guy. I knew you were a cheater, but you're a murderer. I want nothing to do with you. Absolutely nothing.
So I'm trying to think, so he goes to see Cate Blanchett, and this is the part
he's gotta
where
leave town. He just murdered someone and everyone knows he's the connection. Like, I was helping this guy and working with him. So
he goes to see her, and like, they don't really have he's going to get his money. And then she kind of says, I love you, Stan. And he snaps around. And that's where I was a little confused. Why does he snap around in that moment when she says that?
I don't.
Like, he turns
it's
around.
It's been a few weeks since I've
say?
Seen it, but I thought he just freaked out when she dropped the money and he realized that it was all. Did he freaks out her for saying I love you?
Yeah, like he's got his hand in the, he's got his money in the bag, and she says I love you, Stan, and he turns around and he was like, what did you say? And then. All of a sudden, like the reveal is that Cate Blanchett had been working him the entire time.
I don't remember. Do you remember that moment?
I don't remember.
I wish I was more.
I feel
recent.
like he realized like that was a con.
Yeah.
Like
initially,
you know, like
they,
almost like maybe she pushed it too far that he was like, no, you don't.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe
like
he's so good at
do.
Reading people that it didn't seem right, and then he picked up on all the clues.
I think,
that might be
I saw this movie back at the beginning of December, so it's been
I saw it Saturday.
Yeah.
but the money falls to the ground, and he goes to pick it up, and he realizes there's like hundreds wrapped around ones.
Yeah.
So all the money, he's been stashing all the money from these people, the rich people he's been working with. You know, he's been holding it there to keep it quote unquote safe. Well, so we find out the whole time, I mean, she's running a con on him.
Yeah.
And
correct.
It's not necessarily a money thing. Like, she is well respected. She has money and a big office, and it's not for money. It's more like she sees these horrible people, and it's like a power thing. Like, he thinks that he's got one over on her and he's using her, and she realizes he's a terrible person. And I just read it as like, no, she's going to take him down. And he is
awful.
She
did.
Yeah.
And she did. So now Stan's got, now he's on the run double because the security is in the building for this place. And so now he runs into a train yard, hops on a train. And this is probably the biggest giveaway is he hides behind crates of chickens.
Yeah,
like he gets behind crates upon crates of chickens, and it's like, well,
As soon as you saw the chickens on the train, and it doesn't lead directly into it, you know, so it's a little bit more foreshadowing than just like he wakes up and you know, is there, you know. But yeah, you see him hiding on a train where it's just like, oh, this is not going to end well.
Not good.
And he ends up a part of a like a homeless camp.
Right. And then he has to get rid of the watch in question. This is where we get the reveal that he did murder his father.
Yeah, he always wears this watch, and it was the last thing his father ever gave him, supposedly, and so it's supposed to be really special to him. And we see that he basically takes it off his dying father, who he's murdering by opening the window he's on his deathbed.
And he gets kind of hooked up with another, or he finds another circus, and he goes and talks to the guy, and he's like, I'm a mentalist. And he was like, ugh, the mentalist, it's out of stock, out of, you know, nobody cares.
Well,
about
in the
that
time,
anymore.
I'm guessing in the time, like it had been 5 or 6 years since they've honed their act. And I think the, you know, the circus has changed. Like this is a different circus.
Sure.
And
well, he sees like the three eyed baby. And he's like, oh, I bought this off another circus that closed up shop like 6 months ago.
That thing is kind of coming to an end, and he's buying up the remaining things and just salvaging whatever he can. But yeah, so times have changed, and he doesn't really hold the same value that he used to in the circus. Like, you're either a mentalist at a theater, or you're just doing cheap carnival stuff. Like, he was able to walk that line to where he could do a show within a circus, but people are going for the freak show to the circus, and they're going to the theater if they want the fancy mentalism. So he doesn't have a place at the circus anymore, basically.
And this is who was, this is, I was thinking, it's the leader from the Incredible Hulk. What's this guy's name?
Oh, Tim Blake Nelson.
Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah.
And he gives him the Willem Dafoe speech about the geek, and it's the same thing. It's the same sales pitch. And Bradley Cooper realizes what is happening.
Man, that's good.
It is unnerving.
In the first movie, that conversation never happens with how you get a... I should take that back. So in the beginning, I think Pete is talking to him. It's that real quick conversation I mentioned where he's just like, how does a guy become a geek? And then Peter, whoever it was in the original, is just like, well, he used to be, you know, something, and then alcohol, and then he's like, he used to be something. Yeah, it doesn't matter. And they brush it aside. But giving Willem Dafoe that conversation in this one, and then having the guy repeat it word for word, like he learned it from him.
Word.
He had probably that same conversation with Willem Dafoe. Hey, you want to buy this? You want an extra secret for another $10 or whatever?
Right.
Like, he got that exact act from him, and when he repeats it, man, that is impactful. Yep. And but
the look
at this,
on
yeah, at
Bradley
this point
Cooper's
though,
face, the way he plays it,
yeah,
he knows, he realizes,
like
what
he makes
happened.
A choice. He's like, I know what you're doing to me, but I'm still going to let you.
Right,
like,
which is really shows
it's
you
the
how
ending
low.
Of Blair Witch, right, where they just give up.
Yes, you're exactly right.
It's where like they just they're just like, this is what it's gonna be. Like, there's no, we have no control over this.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I think such a good ending here, because he's atoning for his sins. Like, he stands as a terrible person.
Karma came back to full, you know, did a complete 360, literally.
He's
came back and got him in the ass.
He's murdered people. He's lost everyone that he's loved and cared about, and that cared about him. He has nothing less, and he's...
You could argue that he destroyed that circus.
Yeah, I mean, possibly.
You could kind of make that argument.
He did.
He broke that circus up.
Yeah, I mean, Pete died and then left Xena and took Molly.
Took Molly.
So he really is reckoning with everything that he's done. And at this point, he realizes that he is at the bottom of the bottom of people, and he's accepting his place. He's making the choice.
He deserves to be a geek. Yeah. So how did the other movie end with its tacked on happy ending?
So after the scene where the guy is like, I've got something that you can do, you know what a geek is and whatever. And the guy and the stand is like, yeah. Okay. And then it cuts to black. And then the next day people are all running around kind of like in the big, toward the beating of this one, they're like, oh, the geek got out. He's going crazy and he's swinging stuff around and hitting people and whatever. Well, Molly, that had left him, happened to have also showed up at the circus, and she's like looking, and she's like, Stan? And then she goes and finds him cornered, like, you know, like a cornered animal. And she's like, Stan, it's me, Molly. It's me. And he looks at her and he's like, Molly? And they embrace. And so it's like, you kind of see that she's going to save him.
And
he'll have a happy ending. And then the very last thing is, and I really like this line though, and this out of the movie before the end shows up, one of the guys is talking to the new circus owner, and he says, how does a guy get that low? And he got too big. or something. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like basically just saying that he flew too close to the sun.
Right.
He got bigger, mm-hmm. bigger, wanted more and more and more, and he fell all the way down. So I just really like that, how it's just a, you know, I like that line, but I don't like this Stan basically
right.
gets saved by Molly.
Yeah, that's it yeah, reminds me of the yeah. ending of, there's a John Wayne movie called Red River,
okay.
and it's really good,
yeah.
except for the final scene. And they, like, they try to get their happy ending,
yeah.
and they didn't, they shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And, like, the movie's so good. It's, like, one of the best John Wayne performances.
Okay.
It's the first movie I saw, because I didn't start watching old Westerns until I was in my early 20s. And it's the first John Wayne movie I saw where I was like, oh, I didn't realize he was actually a great actor.
Yeah.
Like, right, I just thought he was, like, this big tough guy, and, like, that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And that's what he does in a lot of movies. But there
but
are some
act.
Movies
yeah.
where he kills it, and like yeah. Red River is one of them. Searchers,
yeah.
The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I mean, there are
True Grit.
Yeah, there are some great John Wayne performances out there. But Red River is great. But the
Donovan's
ending,
Reef.
I don't know that I've seen that one.
Yeah, see Donovan's Reef. It's a fun movie. It's dated,
yeah.
but it's more of a carefree. Like he's on this island, and he's
got
a, yeah. It's,
gotcha. But yeah, Red River. If you've never seen it, is totally worth seeing because it's the performance is great. The story's great. It's just they give themselves a cheat to a happy ending, which makes
okay.
no sense.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I love this movie. This is one of my favorite movies of the year.
The more I've talked about it, you might have talked this into being my favorite Del Toro movie. Maybe.
The more I think about it, and again, watching the original, and the original's really good.
Yeah.
So like seeing how they adapted this.
He took a good movie and made it better.
And really.
Which is not a
It's hard,
thing.
Especially with
yeah.
classics, and like this is like the original has a Criterion edition. Like it's a well-received film,
right.
1947, and so he took this and yeah, really made it great, and you know it holds up, and I think that he improved on things. Like you said, I mean, he does. They're both very good, but like the thing, little touches like that he adds and changing the ending makes it that much more impactful. Like Stan accepts his place, and that is his future. Like
yeah.
he doesn't get to be saved. He's
right.
done enough bad things to where.
Sure.
He understands and accepts that he deserves that.
Yeah. But yeah, totally worth seeing. If you listen to this and you haven't seen it and you're like, well, it's ruined for you, but it's still totally worth seeing.
But then it's kind of like watching it, like going back a second time.
Right.
Now you can see the things that
totally.
We're talking about and,
yeah.
and see how mm-hmm. well they're.
It,
the, yeah.
Really good movie. So, well, anyway, there I guess go. That's it for this one. Let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online, facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. And of course, don't forget our Patreon, patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Neff kills Phyllis.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice cause we already warned you. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot. Real spoilers. Real spoilers. Real spoilers.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.